This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Subscribe to the podcast Beyond Politics. They host some of the biggest names and smartest minds. Beyond Politics is from a former Democratic congressman who helped ignite Barack Obama's campaign and a former campaign manager and political columnist. They go beyond the usual chatter on politics, news, science, and books. It's politics and everything beyond. On Beyond Politics, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Broadcasting live on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, and in the evenings on WCPT 820 Chicago's Progressive Talk. It is the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Good to be with you today. Matt and Patrick here today. A busy 4 o'clock hour here locally in the Twin Cities. We've got Richard Thompson from the History Theater is going to join us, as well as Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer. But we are wide open here. This hour, you're more than welcome to call us 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Patrick, how are we today?
Not doing too bad. It's, you know, kind of a nice day outside. It's kind of a warm wind, even though the temperature is a little chilly.
Oh, but we're going to get some nice, this big snowstorms coming through a little bit later on this week and into this weekend here. I don't mind it. The most important thing is, who are you picking to win the NCAA tournament, man?
It's hard to go against Connecticut, which means they obviously will not win it.
Yeah. there's so many people picking them. I'm going to say they could be the 116 upset we've been all waiting for here. Has that ever happened on the men's side? It happened on the women's side.
Yeah, it's happened a couple of times. Purdue a couple years ago, Virginia was the first one, and they lost by 20.
Yeah, that's right. Well, dating karma. Arizona is kind of the off the board pick. I think might be the one that takes everyone out. I think I'm gonna go with Arizona. So this is the most garbage week of work. This makes the holidays, like week between Christmas and New Year's, look like, you know, you're the industrial age. I mean, no one gets any work done this week. How many brackets have most of us filled out this week? Exactly. And can I just say this? If you're one of these people who's like, I like to fill my bracket out with all these playing games, oh, the heck with you. Stop that. No, just fill out a bracket. You know, wonder which 16 seed's got no chance. Come on, man. Just fill out a bracket. Go with it. And then there is, this is why I think in the realm of sports, I don't think there is anything better than Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday in this country, where it is wall-to-wall basketball starting at like 10 a.m. until midnight. You'll see, and just lots of great games. So, as you can see, I'll be here the entire. This is gonna be my Thursday show. Oh, come on, man! I got them moving on. Damn it! I mean, sure. Topics. 952-946. So a pretty standard affair. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. I want to start. Generally, for the Chicago folks, I don't want to just bring up in this hour Minneapolis-St. Paul stuff, because I know, you know, it's, that becomes very localized and you guys, you know, you don't want to hear it. And that's fine. That's cool. I mean, I try to give stuff that has a national feel, or something at least we can talk about on a larger scale to give us a little bit more of a perspective. And I'm going to talk about... I'm going to talk a little bit about two issues, which are actually prevalent here, but actually have a lot of applications, outside of the Twin Cities. Because this first one I want to talk about has to do with wages. And to set this up, I want to bring in the point of experience I have had, and I think a lot of people have had. There is, even in Democratic states where the Democrats are generally pretty much in control, there is a tendency for a very conservative Republican business model to move in and undermine the economic stability and security of the workforce that you have. It's something that's blatant in places like Oklahoma and Texas and Florida, but it's a little bit more sneaky when it comes to these Democratic states. And what it comes down to is this argument that somehow, some way, outside of the compensation you receive from the employer, that you are going to somehow have other things that will make up for the lackluster amount of money that you're going to get paid to make it actually fiscally viable for you to work there. And it is a real Republican thing, because this is what motivates people in red states to say, oh, well, we're only going to pay you $2 an hour, but you get to keep all your tips. And I'll get back to that here in a second. I want to preface this but with a few stories myself that I have had. I'll never forget the wide open, eye-open experience I had with this in regards to pizza delivery. When I was a kid, I delivered for Domino's, back in the 1980s. And I got hired there, and I remember going back to my dad, and my dad said, well, how much money are they paying you? And I said, this much. And he said, well, you're not going to make enough money to... You're barely going to be enough money to cover your cost of your gas. You're definitely not going to be able to cover the cost of the oil changes and the tires and the upkeep of the vehicle. That's going to be out of pocket. You're actually losing money to take this job there. And I'm like, really? So I went back to my boss at that point and I said, hey, it doesn't sound like this is going to be enough to justify me working here. And I was going to quit. And he said, no, don't quit. Here's what you do. And this is what they told me. Here's what you do. You claim all this stuff in your taxes. You write it off on your taxes, and you're going to get all your money back then. Oh, okay. That sounds like, okay, I'll just go the long way around. Now, this was a lie. It was a bold-faced lie, too, and an outright blatant lie. And they knew it at the time when they told you this. This is how they justified. You know, they threw this tax line out, not because it was true, but because they're trying to get you to placate you, because they didn't want to admit the fact that, no, they don't pay you enough money to do the job. At least they didn't back then. So I was little Johnny, tutorial there. I had that book that we had in the car where you kept track of your daily mileage. And every time I worked, I wrote it down. I did that. I kept every receipt for every oil change, every gas fill up, all this stuff. I kept everything. Did it, got to do my taxes the next year. And yeah, I was about $9,000 short, or $7,000. I can't remember exact amount, but I was nowhere near the amount of money invested in the vehicle and the amount of miles invested in the vehicle to get close to actually writing it off. And as a matter of fact, my dad pointed out, he said, you could have worked full time there and you would still be probably have been short of being able to write all this off. So this was just basically a ripoff scheme. And when I went back to the boss afterwards, because I was a little miffed, because that's what they told me, that you can just write this off. They basically insulted me, saying, well, it's not my fault you guys didn't understand the tax code, even though he had said to me at that point, this is how you do it. And then repeated, well, you knew what you signed up for when you got it, so stop complaining and get to work, which I promptly quit. Because, no, I don't believe in getting jerked around by people. I'm not a big fan of that. I had another situation like this. This was maybe about 20 years ago. I had just gotten back to the Twin Cities after working in Iowa for a while, and a radio station that was a little out of the metro area wanted somebody with radio experience to come do their Fridays and Saturday nights. So I was driving an hour out of the metro area at that point to do some radio. It was a long haul, and it did not pay very well. But when I was there, I didn't ask for this. This was volunteered to me. The station owner at that place basically said, don't worry, we'll give you once every two weeks a coupon so you can fill up your gas tank at the local gas station. That will cover the missing expense. Great, no problem. Okay, fine, no problem. So I worked there 1 month. I was driving, and it was an hour out, hour back. It was working late in the evenings. My weekends were shot. I was exhausted. And I finally said, well, wait a second here. I'm supposed to get a gas coupon. And so I go to the owner. I said, hey, remember you told me about these gas coupons and this gas coupons? Gas coupon? Where did you ever get the idea that there was going to be gas coupons? And I looked at him. Now, at this point, I had been in the industry long enough. I was not a fresh-faced radio broadcaster. I could tell someone was about to do this. And I said, you told me there would be some. Well, I don't remember telling you. I'll tell you what, I'll give you one this time, maybe one every 2 months. And I said, save the gas coupon. I'm done here. And he called back like 2 days later and said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll give you one a month. And I said, no, you were just dishonest. And I'm not going to come to work for someone who's dishonest. If you haven't figured out, I'm not a big fan of being jerked around, man. I am not a big fan of it. So I kind of just remove that from my life. So good luck, ta-ta, cheerio, bon voyage. See you later, alligator. So you do have in both these cases a lie that has been perpetuated to get you to sign on to the job, when in both of those cases, there was never any chance that that job was actually going to be fiscally viable. In that case, which brings us to what's actually going on in the city of Minneapolis itself. And it has to do with the Uber Lyft drivers. And Minneapolis has a policy that they have a wage standard that, you have to get paid a certain amount of money, a livable wage standard for the city. Funny thing is that the Uber and Lyft drivers have not been part of this agreement. And last year, when the Democrats in Minnesota passed all these laws, one few that got vetoed and got sent back was the Uber Lyft bill that was going to pay these guys. And Uber and Lyft, these rideshare companies, have basically said, if you make us pay these people, then we're going to leave. Now, it goes back to, and by the way, and when Governor Walls up here vetoed this bill, they did a study on the Uber Lyft drivers and where was the salary here and what was going on. And what it was discovered is this. There's the lie is that Uber and Lyft tell their drivers, well, you're going to get tips. You don't have to get paid from us. You're going to be rolling in the cash. Hey. Funny story. They discovered, about 40% of the people that used an Uber Lyft ride tipped them. So the vast majority, I think it was actually even lower than that, if I remember correctly, like a third. So the majority of people that use Uber and Lyft do not tip the Uber and Lyft driver, which, yeah, that kind of cuts into the lie a little bit, makes it a lot less viable of an option to do something like that. So we are at an interesting junction. I'll tell you what, I'll come back more on this when I do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show. It is the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So, yeah, there's the lie that's being told that if you are, you're one of these drivers, that guess what? We'll go on out there and you can not only you'll get some pay from us, but what you're going to get is tips. Well, they're not getting the tips. Henceforth, they are basically losing money on these as a rideshare driver. And it's not enough for them to live off of. And, you can sit there and say, well, it was never meant to be a living. That's irregardless. You got people that are doing the job for a full-time job, and they're not making enough money to the wage there. It's similar to, and I had some friends who used to do the grocery shopping. Now, I'm just going to be, I don't know about you guys. I am just a guy. I like to grocery shop, man. I'm one of these people that I like to choose my own vegetables, my own meats. I've seen the shoppers at some of these grocery stores, you know, just get really bad cuts or really lame looking vegetables and just chuck them into a bag. And they're not the mentality, the shopping, you know, the will shop for you companies put forward is they're out there making sure you get the best product. And they're just looking at whatever, ding, ding, ding. That doesn't seem to be. And one of the things is that the people that had known that worked there, their whole thing was, well, yeah, you got to get tips. You got to get tips. You got to get tips. And they would even go as far as to suggest you spending like $20 on fun holiday decorations or coming dressed up as someone else and doing these things. And none of it worked. I mean, you just did not get tipped because the people that were having you do this generally didn't look at it as a service that was saving them time. And so they looked at it as, you know, that they themselves went to the grocery store and they didn't do it. And so it's the same thing. If the tips are not there, then there's a problem here. And the mistake that is made whenever you have this case, I know you have this in certain industries in Chicago and you have them in Minneapolis, is that what is the mentality that when you expose the fraudulent nature of this, is it, boy, the business model is wrong. It doesn't work. These people don't get paid. No, the narrative is always blame the driver, blame the employee, blame the worker. Well, you're just not working hard enough to get the tips. And you see, that's them telling you, well, just write off your mileage on your taxes. They know that you have no responsibility to what happens with someone tipping you. And I was stunned like this when they did this study up here in Minnesota to determine what was with the rideshare apps, the few people that do tip. I tip. I get a rideshare, I'm tipping. And I remember I did it in New Orleans. I was like, wow. It wasn't a substantial tip. It was like $10. They're like, wow, you made my night. I'm like, really? Yikes. I thought I was being a cheap bastard. Yeah, it is. But I tip. I went to lunch today with my brother. My brother's in town. We went out and grabbed some lunch. I tipped. Because I understand that is a part, you know, that is part of what these wages are. And I appreciate the service. But stunningly, a lot of people don't do it. Fine. But the business model is the problem. It's not the worker who can't force somebody to tip them. And there is the thing which is really hard about that reality is that there are plenty of Democrats and Republicans that seem to adopt the idea of, well, we understand you're doing this, you know, in the case of Minnesota where they're trying to try and Minneapolis are trying to increase the wages. You know, well, let me start with what the Republican guy said here. He's like this is a Republican, Elliot Engen. He called the Minneapolis ordinance well-intentioned, but said drivers now worry about being unemployed. Well, so either you work for crap wages or you don't have a job at all. Is that really a choice? I mean, and I appreciate the Republican here saying, oh, at least the idea of giving these guys a livable wage is a noble idea. But then he falls back to it. But it's just you can't do it with this. And I think that is a large problem here. Why are we as a society accepting the idea that there is a job field out there that, you know, those minimum wage, those other workers' rights things, they don't exist for them? Because I got to get over to the football stadium. I got to get over to Wrigley. I got to go over to the U.S. Bank Stadium. I got to go do these things. No. You shouldn't. It shouldn't be like that. I think that if the idea is that people, and by the way, this is, if you ever want an example of why I am 1,000,000% against the idea of getting rid of the minimum wage, because Republicans always talk about that. We don't need that. People are going to pay a decent wage. They're already, this conservative business model is already desperately trying to find ways to screw people out of their wages. And do it with vigor and oomph. That's the crazy part, man. So, no, yeah, you know, thank God we have minimum wage laws, because I guarantee you, even, you know, what are decent paying jobs now would be down to $4 an hour if they didn't. And then just the argument would be, you need to get tipped. I mean, everything, like even like house painters would, well, we're only going to pay you $2 an hour. But if you do a good job and you, I don't know, put on some, you know, some St. Patrick's Day costumes and dance around the house, maybe you'll get a nice tip. Or the police called on you. It's one of the two. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to go. But as much as I would like to rip on just the Republicans on this, the Governor Walz here has once again come on out. He'd like to find a statewide solution on driver pay and lamented the council made the decision affecting the whole state without the backup plan to replace the rideshare drivers, with no intention, indication the council is willing to reverse course. He wasn't optimistic, even as legislators raced to offer solutions. The Republicans in the state are basically saying that we need to make a law that says you can't regulate wages in any community, which is a garbage idea. I think that that is they're definitely trying to use this situation to push their agenda. But even the Republican or even the Democrats are of the mindset of, well, yeah, it's right. We want everyone to have a livable wage, but we're not willing to do it. Why not? Uber and Lyft, I think, was it? Is Uber going to leave both Minneapolis and St. Paul, the metro area as a whole? Or is it? Yeah, I think that Lyft is only leaving Minneapolis. That's what they've said. Well, we live in a capitalist system. I guarantee you it's a pretty large metro area. Somebody will be out there offering a rideshare offer option. And yes, it will be a little bit more expensive, but it will pay a livable wage. And as Uber and Lyft go take their toys and go home, how long will they allow another competitor to come into a market by themselves, especially a large market with Target Center, Target Field, the U.S. Bank Stadium, the Gopher Stadium in it, the concert venues, the Armory and stuff like that are in downtown Minneapolis? How long will that, First Avenue, how long will they allow that to go and have carte blanche over all that before they come? You know, we were just joking. Sure, we'll pay a livable wage. If it's worthwhile, it's worthwhile. That's all I'm going to say. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Broadcasting in the evening on WCPT 820 Chicago's Progressive Talk, and in the afternoons on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. You see, that, by the way, I want to bring up one thing about that wage issue, which is a problem for the left too. We have a lot of idealists there. Oh, we want low-income housing. Great. We're going to build it half a block from your house. Well, not here. Well, yeah, there. You know, if you want to do the whole, you know, a fair and equal tide raises all boats sort of mentality, you can't basically have the mentality of, well, you know, not in my neighborhood, not here. Yesterday, we talked to Dermot Flanagan, and he talked about, wasn't that a very interesting comments that he had about immigration into Ireland versus how we hear it here? I mean, in Texas, they're like, we want to put a round in every one of their skulls. I don't care if they're a baby. They deserve to die. That sort of thing. I mean, that is your Christian right there. And he's like, bring them on in. Yeah, he was talking about that, they've, you know, hotels are being completely booked out with, you know, immigrants and refugees. Bring them on in. It's always been my mentality is that if you've got someone who's hungry, give them a damn sandwich. We can figure out the problem later. We just have this idea of, as idealists, we need to fix this. We need to have a living wage and all these things. But then all of a sudden, when a minor conflict or a minor thing makes you feel uncomfortable, the left has this really bad habit of, maybe we shouldn't. That's not bravery. That's not a showcase in you know, being valiant. You know, it's basically, it's kind of running away from your issues, that they're not really issues for you. Do people deserve to have a living wage? Yeah. All right. Well, then you got to fix this problem. And if the companies say we're going to leave because unless we can pay them crap wages, we don't want to be here. Well, should they be there? Okay. Have a nice time. Oh, yeah, we understand. All our best. When someone says, well, we're going to build you, we're going to that empty lot, we're going to build some low-income housing. You know, as opposed to say, not in my neighborhood. You can build that in the other part of town. Oh, just, you know, great. I have more neighbors. That's what raising the tide equally means. 952-946-6205. A guy that has no idea about that term, Trump. I want to remind everybody what Donald Trump said on Saturday. Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country, the ex-president said. Once again, most of the media pretty much ignored that. So it'd be not a big surprise to you to find out that most of the media as well has ignored this latest one, which is, oh God, this is ugly stuff, man. And I want to say this, this story actually has been covered more than the bloodbath story in my mind, but there are still a lot of news outlets I was paying attention to that did not have not posted a thing on this. On CNN, though, they did talk about it. They basically struck back at Trump after he lobbed an angry attack at the majority of American Jews. Trump this week told right-wing podcaster Sebastian Gorka that any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel. They should be ashamed of themselves. Wow. I want to imagine, this is Donald Trump saying this. This is a guy who claims to be Christian, who never goes to church, who he's a textbook biblical villain, for God's sakes. He is everything God and Jesus warned us against. And he feels as if it's his position to tell the Jewish population of the state, of this country, that, you know, unless you vote for him, you hate your religion and you hate Israel. Wow. That is a level of bigotry and anti-Semitic rhetoric that you just generally don't hear too often. And once again, most of the media in this country, he's just being a scamp. He's a rascal. Yeah. Yeah. Given that more than two-thirds of American Jews support Joe Biden in 2020, Trump was saying that a supermajority of Jews in America hate their own religion. New Yorker reporter Evan Osnos was quick to point out that all the reasons that Trump's comments were completely out of line, it's very offensive, frankly, to American Jews. I think the idea on one hand that people would hate the state of Israel because their opposition to a policy is something that bothers people. Also, the assumption that Jewish identity means support necessarily for Israeli policies is also something that really bothers people. Former Bush White House communications director Kate Bedingfield chimed in to say that Trump's remarks were offensive and some would agree hateful. She then said that Trump's outbursts such as these would help Biden shore up wavering support among his own voters, some of whom have threatened to withhold support from him over his back in the Israeli war against Hamas in Gaza, and that has led to the death of an estimated 30,000 Palestinians. It's probably well over 30,000 at this point. I think it's more you hear Trump's voice, his honest thoughts are, the better that comparison is for Biden. Now, let me first talk to both anyone, if you're a strong supporter of Israel or if you are a strong supporter of Palestine. Let me start with the people that support Israel. When Donald Trump at Charlottesville said there were good people on both sides, he was basically directly saying there were good Nazis. Yes, those Nazis. I think we all remember them. His party is run rampant with Nazis. Not everybody in the Republican Party is a Nazi, but Nazis vote for Republicans. That's a fact. You have the Trump campaign actually airing ads, I think it was on YouTube, on a Nazi, on a Nazi channel or somewhere. I don't know if it was YouTube or where it was, but they said, oop, that was an accident. No, that was by design. He basically keeps claiming he's for Israel, and they cannot talk about how much they don't want to tell the Nazis to not vote for them. I mean, there has been some incredibly anti-Semitic statements that have come out of the Republican Party. And if you think for one second that somehow, some way, Donald Trump really cares about the Jewish faith, the Jewish people, or Israel for that matter. Because reminder, Israel and Russia do not like each other. It's a decent chance the Russians gave the information on how to access Israel for that attack back in October. And at the end of the day, who do you think Trump is going to side up with? Vlad or Bibi? Yeah, it's going to be Vlad. That guy can't put on his knee pads fast enough for Vladimir Putin. He just cannot. So if you're of the pro-Israeli side, you keep that in mind before you vote for Donald Trump blindly. For the people who are supporting Palestine and what has happened there, I read this article right before I came on about Jared Kushner. I guess he was talking to Harvard, and he was talking about how great all that beachfront property in Gaza is going to be, and actually suggested we should just take all the Palestinians, chuck them out in the desert somewhere, and then take over the entire Gaza area and build luxury resorts. Yeah, and by the way, that from the Republicans is one of the least offensive things that you have heard said. I've heard Republicans make the argument that the Palestinians should all be shot, every one of them. Not one, multiple Republicans have argued that all the Palestinians, including the children, should be lined up and all killed. So as you sit there and you try to make the argument that Joe Biden's failed us, you do realize what the other side has said that they want to do. And I think you can understand that no matter what side of that conflict you're on, the worst guy for you to vote for is the great orange turd. All right? That's, you know, Jabba the Butt over there. No, he is not on either of your side. Unless you've got $464 million lying around, he does not care about you. He does not care about you. That's just a fact. The brazenness of trying to, I want you to think about this. And by the way, this is something for the people in the Jewish faith. This is something that you see Republicans push in Christian churches. As a matter of fact, I had a woman get in touch with me, talk about her church out in western rural Minnesota and how they basically said, if you vote Democrat, you're not welcome in the church. I'm like, wow, really? Yep. So she hasn't been back. Good news is a lot of other people haven't been back either. And she did say that the church was calling around to the members and saying, you know, we really didn't mean that. I mean, we think you should vote Republican, but we're not going to tell you not to come here anymore. And I think the damage has been done. This wrapping yourself in the flag and religion and false patriotism is exactly what you think it is. This is the march towards fascism. That if you're Jewish, your faith means nothing. Voting for him means everything. If you're Christian, your faith means nothing. You have to vote for him to be a good Christian. You basically, if you vote for as a Democrat, you are somehow anti-Israel. And yeah, that question has become a lot murkier lately. Let's be honest about it. But I don't. You if you're putting litmus tests on whether or not they vote for you, that tells you everything you need to know about him. And this is some scary stuff, people. I brought up the bloodbath thing yesterday. And the point being that he knows that if Joe Biden wins, which I am fully expecting Joe Biden to win in November, if Joe Biden wins, then what happens is Kamala Harris will be the vice president overseeing the Electoral College vote. So Trump knows January 6th will not work. His only goal right now, his only goal is to basically win at all costs, no matter what, because it's the only way he doesn't go bankrupt. It's the only way he doesn't go to jail. It's the only way he doesn't pay massive fines. Because the further he gets from the White House, the less interested Israel is to give them $500 million. The less interested Russia is to give him $500 million. So he has to win. And so that bloodbath comment is basically a signal that if we do not win in November, that the war begins then. That's how I'm taking it. Because he has to overthrow the government prior to the Electoral College if he's going to have any chance. And that's all this guy is. And my guess is if these people do and it quickly gets quashed down, because it's like I said, a bunch of drunk Republicans trying to, I got my gun. Well, welcome to the 10th Mountain Division. Good luck with that. When that gets quelled pretty damn quickly, you know, traitors, you know, enemies domestic and foreign, when we knock you all down, my guess is Donald Trump will jump on an airplane and go to a country where there is no extradition, Saudi Arabia or a Russia, and sit there and say, it was my only option. They were so bloodthirsty to try to get me to be held accountable for trying to overthrow the government of the United States a second time. Yes, yes. This is, and reminder, newspapers, most news is not even covering this. They are not even covering this. Let's take a break. Come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show. It is the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday, 952-946-6205. Steve is in Minneapolis. Steve, thanks for holding. Welcome on in.
Oh, yeah, I guess there's three of me now, the way I've heard. But anyway, on the subject of the rideshare thing,
yes,
I only use union taxis. And I'll tell you why real quick. I used to work with a guy who, hardcore righty, always carried a gun, got fired because of his hot temper, and guess what he was doing the next day? Driving an Uber Lyft. What I wish we would do is, if you've ever seen the regulations for cabbies in London, oh my God, you got to have a degree.
Well, and Steve, right? And Steve, I appreciate the phone call. It's there. I think we'll go just with the one thing about cabs. If you are in a situation where your rideshare groups are leaving because the companies are upset about a fair wage getting paid to the drivers, well, cabs still exist. And if I may make a suggestion, if you tip, what they're going to look at you and do is saying, here's my card. You ever need me, give me a call. I'll be there. And so it will be kind of like your own private rideshare. And so, yeah, that's always an option there. But like I said, you got a tip. 952-946-6205. Let's head to Nebraska, shall we, people? Oh, God. A Nebraska Republican legislator horrified colleagues by substituting in some of their names into a graphic account of a rape from a novel. State Senator Steve Dumbass, Halloran, from Nebraska, read an excerpt from the novel Lucky by Alice Siebold during a debate over the obscenity bill, but apparently tried to make a point by substituting in the name of State Senator Michelle Kavanaugh, a Democrat from Omaha, into graphic scenes of sexual violence, reported the Nebraska Examiner. This was out of line and unnecessary and disgusting to say my name over and over like that, said Michelle Kavanaugh. You don't know anything about anyone else's life. I can tell you that women in this body have been subjected to sexual violence. She added, I don't know why you're capable of such cruelty. That was so unbecoming of you and unbecoming of this. Halloran did not use her first name and didn't make clear whether he meant Kavanaugh, who he'd spoken to in opposition to the bill. He did say her name at the beginning of the discussion, so it was clear that this was the setup. They basically, it seemed to be clear that he was going after her. Honestly, I think Halloran should resign, said State Senator Megan Hunt, a Democrat from Omaha. How dare he even form his mouth to say the words, give me blank, Senator Kavanaugh, and said that because he wanted to say it. It was beyond the pale, pure aggression to read a rape scene out loud and put it like that. Broken brain. State Senator Julie Slama, another Republican, also called for him to step down. Disgusting, Slammer wrote in a tweet. No context makes this appropriate. Halloran warned colleagues and live stream viewers he would be quoting from hearing testimony from last year when a person testified and read passages from Lucky that graphically depicts a rape of the author survived in college, and its recitation lasted about 83 seconds. We talk about my kids having experiences in my school. Doesn't matter, Halloran said. If it is just one school that experiences, it's one's too many, basically talking about the book. But I think in most cases, a book like this is not necessarily available in the counter. This is just something that they're paranoid in their head. And I want to make sure I point this out to you, Republicans. We see how much you guys enjoy reading these salacious texts. It seems to me that you guys are far more creepy with this stuff than anyone else is. As a matter of fact, if anyone is too immature to be reading these books, it's the Republicans that keep reading them. Did you hear that? Oh, did you hear that? I'm going to put my coworker's name in there. Oh, dear Lord. Does anybody doubt this dude's online social history is really disturbing? I can only imagine what this dude's DMs look like. Ugh. Lucky was one of the most banned books in the country during the 2021-22 school year, and both the public speaker from last year and Halloran read to it support a bill sponsored by another senator who was out of the room at the time but later said she was mortified that Kavanaugh's name was invoked. I don't want to listen to this, but deep down inside, this is what's happening, Albrecht said. I will be my first to stand up and say I'm sorry. I'm sorry that we even have to read anything like this. In an email obtained by the Examiner, Halloran described the passages how to rape lesson and said he only regrets that the liberals are not upset the book was in school libraries and told a Nebraska teacher. In another email, he was referring to Kavanaugh's brother. Michelle Kavanaugh, however, cast doubt on that claim, saying it was distinction without a difference. He invoked both of our names at the start and then dropped the first name. She posted on X, whatever one of us, whichever one of us the assault was meant for doesn't make it any less horrific. Though I believe it was directed at me, men can also be victims of assault and response to the dismissal of the fact. The fact that the guy did that, by the way, that he said, it's not offensive because I was talking about a guy having this done to him, just tells you the mindset of these people. Book burning, condemning of the Jews, calling for a bloodbath. I wonder if those schools and those libraries have a history book in there, because we are going down a freaking path here, aren't we? You wonder how this stuff happens, people. You wonder how this stuff happens. I was stationed in Germany with the military, and it's the great question that the Germans have had to wrestle with. How did they allow that to happen? How did they allow the Nazis? And, it was because they had a guy in Adolf Hitler who was able to appeal to the worst elements of them, the worst traits of their as people, and was able to form that into a viable political force. Sounds somewhat familiar, doesn't it? Hey, it's not like there's warning signs. I granted, the news media is surely not saying a damn thing right now, which is they're pretty much complicit in this whole thing, kind of like in Germany. But, you know, for God's sakes, people, there isn't a question this election cycle. Is there? Chicago, have a good one. We're back tomorrow. Minneapolis, St. Paul, hour two up next. Hour number two of the show here on your Tuesday. Good to have you with us today, Matt and Patrick. Brett will stop on by and talk about his interview with Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer a little bit later on. Also, a little bit later on this hour, we are going to be giving away a pair of tickets to the Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Show coming to Minneapolis, St. Paul in April. Fugelsang, Sparks, Frangela, the whole crew are coming in. We will give away a pair of tickets today, so you got to listen for your chance to call in and win those tickets. Not now. That's coming up here in a little bit. But to start off this hour today is Richard Thompson. He's the artistic director for the History Theater. He is has more than 30 years of experience as a director, administrator, choreographer, drama teacher, performer. He can seeks to build on History Theater's important legacy of creating new and exciting work while exploring the history of Minnesota, the Midwest, and diverse American experience. He's kind enough today to join us to talk about not only the theater, but also a unique assignment, which is currently playing over at the History Theater until April 7th. Richard, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure here. Now, of course, you're over in St. Paul. There, right? Kind of near, kind of towards the Capitol up there on the downtown side.
Right in the capital city. What can I say?
Beautiful. For people out there, because we do have a lot of theaters and sometimes people might not be aware of this, let's talk right from the get-go about the History Theater. What is the goal and the purpose of the History Theater?
Well, the goal and purpose of the History Theater is to tell plays and tell stories that are about history. Many theaters and, have plays that maybe set in a period of time, but here we are talking about real stories, real events, real people. And so that is our mission, is to tell stories about history. And some of those, and most of those stories have to do with Minnesota history, but we also look beyond as well to really share stories about the American experience. So that's what we're about as far as what we do upon the stage, behind the scenes. What we do is we look to hire as many playwrights as possible, because these stories that we tell about history aren't plays that you could normally just go to and pull off the bookshelf. So we have to create this work. So we're probably the biggest theater here in town when it comes to do original work, certainly that which is and directly associated with history. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do here.
Well, and it's got to be, how do you approach that in the sense being, is obviously, like you said, there's not a lot of pre-made plays or pre-written plays or established plays that probably apply to what your goal and focus is. So when you bring in a story like this, talk a little bit about that process, because, there's a lot of great stories. There's a lot of great stories history-wise that either funny, serious, political, quality of life growing up in Minnesota. How do you find the story and then say, you know what, there's something here. We can actually flesh this out into a full play.
Yeah, well, it's funny you ask that, because there's never one way that we go about it. Sometimes someone will just come in with an idea. They may have a relative or something like that. Sometimes it might be the author of a book. And we contact them and go, hey, this book, this seems interesting. Sometimes it's a playwright who comes in with an idea. Sometimes it might be something that myself or others think about and go, this should be a play. So it happens many, many different ways. My approach is all is for consideration. The other thing that we look at is it something that audiences might be interested in hearing about? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it may be something that may not be so familiar to an audience, but we think, this is something that they should know about. How can we tell a story about that individual or about that event and make it interesting for an audience? So there's no one way that we go about it, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
How there must be a bit of a screening process to make sure, because obviously, like I said, there's a lot of great stories out there that you don't have to, you know, add drama to. There, it's, you don't have to enhance. It's there. But I imagine it is, it sometimes is difficult because, you know, you want a story and you want to have a little punch and stuff like this. Talk about that process of saying, you know what, we want a good production here, but we don't want something that's so embellished that it's, it kind of misses the point.
Absolutely. Well, as you say, there's lots of drama already in historical events. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we look to focus in is on who are the people that are involved in those events. Events don't happen without people, you know? Mm-hmm. So the first thing that we want to do is really tell the story so we understand what's behind the event. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a process that we go through that when it comes to plays, whether it's a play that someone has brought in, they've already worked on, or it's a work that we've commissioned, we have a workshop process, and we call it raw stages. And in that, what happens is a play is brought in, we get some professional actors, a dramaturg, a director, and they go through a whole process, 20 hours of workshop, to really look at that play, to flush it out, to see if it's the message and the story is clear. Mm-hmm. So thereafter, then we determine, all right, is this something that we should move forward with? So sometimes any play that one sees upon the stage here at History Theater may have taken 2 to 3, 4 years to develop, which is not unusual because we want to make sure that the work is of quality, that the stories are good and interesting to an audience.
I would also say, too, and I know this from going to Fort Snelling, some of the historical societies out there, there is a plethora of actors in this town who seem to have this real love of history to go along with it. So I imagine for you, and I know Minneapolis-St. Paul has already got such a great actor community in it. So for you, I imagine it's got to be nice to have a lot of people here that love history and love acting. And so this is, okay, line up the buffet. Here we go.
That's so true. And we're really fortunate to have a community of actors like that, you know. For many of years, since going back to the 80s and 90s, per capita, we have more theaters in this community than they do in New York City.
Yeah.
So that's quite incredible. And, you know, and having gone around the nation and worked and just traveled, what we have here is so special. And it does make for a great community of actors, but also, too, we have a great community of writers as well. Mm-hmm. With the Playwright Center being located here in this Twin Cities area, there are a lot of writers who are based here, who come here and do work, and find out about this great theatrical community that we have. So for us at History Theater, where we're looking to create new work, it makes for a very good base to pull from as well. So, yeah.
I have a friend of mine, Eric Webster, is an actor here in town, did Tony and Tina's Over for many years. And he sort of said it's one of the two towns he's ever seen that you can actually make a living as an actor. And I said, that's a pretty amazing statement when you think about all the cities that Minneapolis-St. Paul is one of them that you actually, the actors can survive being actors, which is great.
It's really wonderful. And as a result, you know, when we get the actors in the room, they're good workers. You know, they're not dissatisfied. And, you know, certainly, you know, acting can be a very challenging profession. But because there are so many opportunities for those who are members of the union, they actually get to spend all their time being an actor, not having to go work at Trader Joe's or some other place like that.
I can't do the show tonight. I've got a shift. Let's give people an idea of the process here. You've got the current production going on, A Unique Assignment. Talk about this. What is the story behind this play?
So the story behind this show, behind this play, is it looks at and examines that period of time when James Meredith looked to integrate and enroll at the at Ole Miss, mm-hmm, back in 1962, where the Minnesota connection comes in, which is very interesting. There's a young man who went to St. John's University, who participated in ROTC, went into the Army, and as a result of, you know, being a lieutenant in the Army, he was assigned to that Army unit that was to protect James Meredith at Ole Miss as he attempted to enroll there. So there's the connection. There's the Minnesota connection to this really big moment in American history. So the play looks at James Meredith, his reasons for doing it, and the security plan that this Minnesotan had to put in place to protect him.
I imagine it took, I mean, I, I, I'll ask the question. Was there like a field trip? I imagine that to understand this story, I mean, and obviously you talk about playwrights, and there's a lot of great playwrights that have thick, rich, you know, resumes of writing and stuff, and they've had this. I imagine that you had to get some level of perspective from that Southern, that Ole Miss side of it, because it's one thing for us to talk about it here. I can only imagine being sent down there and realizing the importance of what you're about to do and how many people don't want you to do it, as whether it's the individual going to school there or the guardsman protecting that student.
Hear, hear. Well, in the case of Mr. James Meredith, he was quite clear on what he was doing. You know, there were a lot of national civil rights organizations that recommended that he not even pursue this angle of being, you know, of enrolling himself. But he was very clear on what he wanted to do, so he went ahead with it anyway. Mm-hmm. It certainly shocked the federal government, because we know that Robert Kennedy and John F. said, "What are you doing? Oh, no, oh, no, no, we've got to get some protection in there." For Henry Gallagher, it was a unique, it's, you know, assignment, as it were. He really didn't know quite what he was getting into. And as a result of being down there and seeing the circumstances, in the end, it changed his perspective on the world in general. Mm-hmm. Before going down there as an Army lieutenant, 2 years before that, he had hitchhiked through the South and really didn't realize what the differences in politics down there at that time and in culture. Because he was just going through there having a good time as he hitchhiked. However, going down there representing the federal government, he found himself in a very different situation, to say the least.
I can appreciate that as a person that lived in the South. You know, it's kind of one of those things that when it gets pointed out to you, you cannot not see it anymore. You can you see it everywhere, but until you have it pointed out to you, it's a deceptive veil that's drawn over the entire South, and it still is there today. It's still being addressed. But yeah, you know, it's an incredibly brave, you know, story that you're telling here. By the way, we should mention you directed this play.
I did. Yes, I had the pleasure of doing so, and it's written by Mr. Harrison David Rivers, who did a lot of research. You know, he read Henry Gallagher's book. He read several books written by James Meredith, to find out and understand both of their perspectives and situation. And he's put together a great, great play, I have to say.
It is currently running. I want to make sure I mention this. It's currently running until April 7th at the History Theater. Tickets are available. HistoryTheater.com, that's where people can find the information about the shows, right?
That's correct, yes. And they can also call this number, 651-292-4323. For tickets as well. 651-292-4323.
I also, if I can, you have a show coming up here in late June. I wanted to mention this because this once again falls right into, as you were discussing, good stories here that are from Minnesota, developing them out and getting them on the stage. Talk a little bit about the play Glen Sheen that you're going to have in June.
Well, Glen Sheen's a favorite here at History Theater. In fact, it's a musical. It's not just a straight play. Written by Mr. Jeffrey Hatcher, who is a playwright known across the country.
Yeah.
Done great work, done screenplays as well, and composed by Mr. Chan Poling. Some people know him from
Suburbs.
Back in the day. There you go.
The
exactly.
Suburbs. I know, Chan.
That's
yeah.
Right. That's right. That's right. For those of us old enough, we remember going to the clubs and checking them out.
Still the best T-shirt ever made, man. Still the best one.
That's right. So Mr. Hatcher and Mr. Poling have put together this musical called Glen Sheen. And it looks at what happened up at Glen Sheen back in the day when the heiress was killed. And we still to this day don't know exactly who did it, because no one was ever found guilty for doing so. So this musical examines that story. It's delightful. It's a production that we've done a number of years here. We bring it back occasionally because folks love it so much. It's really, really a good show.
All right, and that's, once again, if you want to see this, if you're a fan of that one, June 20th to July 14th, that's at the History Theater. You can get tickets. Can you get tickets for that now?
You can call in right now. They're sitting at the box office right now. If you want to see that one, call in now.
Oh, and you do. That's, you know, obviously, you want to get your tickets for that as soon as you possibly can. Go over there once again. And once again, the current show that's going on, A Unique Assignment, on the stage at the History Theater, and this one runs until April 7th. And
that's
then
correct.
For the full schedule, once again, historytheater.com, they have the full schedule there. You can get, I am presuming, as well, and I will encourage this every time because I think this is one of the best things you can do. Get seasons. Get the season ticket. You guys got season tickets, right?
We got season tickets. We're going to make an announcement about our next season in about 2 or 3 weeks. And at that time, season tickets will go on sale. We've got a great lineup for next season. I can't tell you what it is just yet. Right. But given the history of the History Theater, you know they're going to be good shows.
Richard Thompson, a artistic director and director over at the History Theater, kind enough to take some time with us today. Richard, an absolute pleasure. Anytime you want to, you come on back. By all means, my show is yours.
Give me a call. I'm ready.
Richard Thompson from the History Theater. Let's take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Matt, Patrick, Brett here is in studio now because we had to move the Cooligan interview because obviously I had to talk to Mr. Thompson over at the History Theater. How are you today, Brett?
I'm doing all right. I'm thrown off not hearing our usual hour two music leading me into this segment. So. It was worth it, though. That's a great
show. You think I'm
going
to pass up doing two interviews in an hour, man, so I can just sit back and get the chaise lounge going? I'm sleeping.
especially with a unique assignment. That sounds like a really good play.
It does.
Yeah.
That does sound really cool. All right. So I want to ask you guys something here. And it regards to, so I'm watching, I saw in the Star Tribune, because you guys know sports better than I do. They had the All-Metro basketball team, right?
Oh, yeah. They do that for all the sports. Yeah.
And the five winners of the All-Metro men's basketball team, none of them going to the University of Minnesota. Two of them going to Wisconsin. Then they had the story today of the 36 Minnesota players who are playing in the tournament. Well, since the Gophers aren't playing in the tournament, these are 36 players in the state who have gone to other teams and are excelling on these teams. Okay, what is wrong with the – how is it this – the licensing agreements? Is it these extras? What is going on with Minnesota – Is it the regents over there where they're just kind of, well, they'll want to come here because of the tradition? No, they don't care anymore about tradition. It's about where they're going to get paid. And I think what's happening is there's this antiquated, we don't like this, the NILs? They don't like the NILs. They don't like this paying of players. They don't like all this. So they're going to fight this the entire way while the rest of the country picks this state clean of all of our best players, and we kind of wonder why we don't go to tournaments anymore.
Well, I think another point to bring up, too, with that is that the Gophers have to compete with four major professional sports, and oftentimes colleges and college towns don't have those other pro sports to compete with for those NIL deals. So I think that plays a role as well. But even going before the NIL, Minnesota's been such a hotbed for basketball, and we've gotten none of these great players going to Minnesota. And this is even predating the NIL and the transfer portal and all of those sorts of things. So, well, I think the NIL, certainly not helping Minnesota with all our pro sports. It goes beyond that, too.
Here's where I'm going to come back at you on what your argument is about major market. Okay, so you've got every advertiser going to freaking Iowa City to advertise with that basketball, that, you know, her name down there. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Caitlin Clark. An absolute superstar, though, yeah.
But in your argument would be is wouldn't they want to have a star from Los Angeles, from USC or UCLA, where you bring in that market with it? No, I think it's much more with the schools and their willingness to go on out there and embrace this new system. And this is something I just don't think the Gophers are still there. It's going to be 20 years from now, and they're going to be like, guess what we've decided to do, when they're basically finishing last place in everything but like indoor track and swimming and diving. And I mean, this is going to start impacting not only football and basketball. The hockey teams are going to start getting impacted. If I'm a hockey player, why would I come here if I can go to Michigan State or Ohio State and basically get tons of licensing deals at the same time?
I think that's a fair point, too, because, yeah, Minnesota has generally fallen behind the rest of the Big Ten when it comes to facilities and investment.
Is it just they got to stick their backside or something?
I don't know
like
what it, and it's going to be even tougher now that you have some big teams coming into the Big Ten with big brands like USC, UCLA, Oregon, with a big Nike guy funding that place. How are you going to compete with those schools now, too, if you're Minnesota?
You guys have got to get over your damn selves. You know, this idea of, we're going to turn the clock back to 1960. No, you're not. You're not going to do that. You're losing, and you're losing badly. And it should not be a surprise to you that every one of your best players in your own state do not go to your own college. Instead, go across the country because they're getting paid there. I mean, I was at Ohio State. And I went past their athletic training facility, and it looked like a luxury car dealership because those were the – and it, no one hides it over there. Mm-hmm. Those are all the athletes' cars. They were getting freebie cars, top-of-the-line cars, athletes. I went down there. I would work for a flagship of the Big 12. We would go down to other schools, and the states in those where those schools are at, just covering it up there, paying people left and right. It's just you get these people that's like, well, we're going to do it the good way. Well, you're not going to win. And I get your point of that you want to have this, you know, this noble, antiquated idealism towards your sports programs, but the reality is I think you're damaging yourself far more than you realize because the world's changed and you're just the last one to get on the bus at this point.
I think the dangerous point, too, to come up for a team like Minnesota if they don't invest is that I think we're going to reach an era where major conferences like the Big Ten and the SEC are going to kick schools out and say,
I agree with you.
We're not bringing enough money into the conference, and that's what's really going to, I think, wake people up at Minnesota Athletics.
If you just want to be like this, make yourself Division II.
Just go
Division II, and then you can sit there and say, we've got tradition, and that's because that's what every Division II team sells themselves on, is tradition. Not superstars, nothing there. It's tradition. And just, degrade yourself out of Division I, go to Division II, and then pat yourself on the back on how noble you are, and watch, you know, every other team basically to lap us. Patrick, do you have any thoughts on this? You cover sports a lot here, too, yourself.
Yeah, I think I kind of understand mostly what Brett was saying about, you've got some big schools coming into the conference that's certainly not going to help. And, yeah, that was going to be my comment, too, that this kind of goes back that Minnesota has pretty much been sending Wisconsin to the Elite Eight and Final Four every year for the last 10 years.
We're a pipeline for Wisconsin.
How many on those Wisconsin football teams were really good for all those years? How many of those players were from Minnesota? Exactly. South Dakota, North Dakota, they're just picking our players clean. And so, they can sit there and say, we're going to fight the system, but you're losing. And you've already lost. I mean, the parking lot's empty. Everyone's gone home. And you're sitting there saying, we're winning. You're not. You're just not. Patrick Cooligan does join us. What are you guys touching on today?
Yeah, so he's writing a column that's going to be published tomorrow, but we got a preview of it. He's sharing his thoughts on this controversy with Uber and Lyft threatening to leave Minneapolis over these pay raises that they're getting. And he's going to highlight these competing studies that were released by the city council and the state that are muddying the waters in terms of how much money should we be paying Uber and Lyft drivers. We'll touch that, and then the WALS budget as well, and how they'll work with that and work with the legislature, since there are some differences between what they're proposing.
Before we get into that, Stephanie Miller's Sexy Liberal Save the World comedy tour comes to the Pantages Theater on Saturday, April 13th. It's going to be Steph, it's going to be Fugelsang, it's going to be Hal Sparks, Frangela at the Pantages, April 13th. I've got a pair of tickets to go see the Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Save the World comedy tour right now. Caller number five, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Caller five, you're going to win those Stephanie Miller tickets. Good luck with that. Here is Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. And today we are joined by the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. That's Patrick Cooligan. Learn more about the Minnesota Reformer at minnesotareformer.com for the latest in Minnesota news and politics.
as today we're going to be focused on some, I guess call it budget issues. Now, normally that would sound pretty dry, but what we're talking about today I think is going to be pretty interesting because it's going to have an impact on a lot of Minnesotans, especially if you're someone who uses Uber and Lyft. In fact, we'll be starting off there today with Patrick talking about his column that highlights what's been happening with Uber and Lyft in Minneapolis. We'll also be talking a little bit about the state budget as well. Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So let's start off talking about Uber and Lyft because Minneapolis Uber and Lyft drivers look like they are set to get a pay raise beginning on May 1st. That's because last week the Minneapolis City Council voted by a 10-3 margin to override a veto from Jacob Fry that sets a minimum pay rate for drivers. Uber now says they are going to leave the entire Twin Cities on May 1st, while Lyft says they will cut service in Minneapolis. Now, it does seem like everyone, in terms of lawmakers, agrees that the rates for Uber and Lyft drivers need to be raised, but by how much is the question? The city council is basing their idea, which says that they are going to pay drivers $1.40 per mile and 51 cents per minute, are what's required to help drivers maintain the city's minimum wage of $15.57. So again, that's $1.40 per mile and 51 cents per minute. But there was another report released by the state which showed that the rates only needed to be $1.20 per mile and 49 cents per minute. That would allow drivers to be able to meet their minimum requirements and the minimum wage in Minneapolis. So there's lots to unpack here, including the difference between these two reports. And let's start off there talking about the difference between these reports, because initially when I saw there, I see one report that's saying we need a higher minimum wage and one the other, I originally thought, well, this one from that's proposing a lower wage probably is coming from some industry-friendly reporter. But it turns out these are both very labor-friendly reports, but there's certainly a big methodology difference in terms of how both of these numbers were arrived at. And that's kind of the crux of the issue in terms of why we're having this debate about setting these pay rates for Uber and Lyft drivers.
Yeah, I think that first thing to note was that the city council passed their ordinance the day before this big state report came out. And the council knew that it was coming out. And let me highlight the quality of that state report. It includes an analysis of more than 18 million rides that all Minnesotans took in 2022 with Uber and Lyft. It's the first kind of report of its kind. So a massive amount of data. And you know, I think anybody who's an advocate of good government would say that's a little bit questionable when the council knew that this big state report that we've all been waiting for 6 months, really, we've been waiting for it. It's coming out on a Friday. They knew it was coming out. It's curious to me that they went ahead anyway and passed their own ordinance. And as you said, there are differences between the city report they ordered up. It just doesn't have the range of data that the state Department of Labor has. I should also note that the state, the Department of Labor and Industry, their report, they commissioned these two economists, one from the New School, one from University of California, Berkeley. These are labor-friendly guys. I'm working on a column now, and I noticed that they wrote a commentary for the New York Daily News that endorsed New York City's driver pay ordinance. So it's not like these guys are some company hacks. If you read the report, I mean, it's pretty detailed and extensive. And I think it's also worth noting that the companies attacked their report. So I certainly wish, and I think a lot of people wish, that the city council had just waited. But it sure looks to me like they wanted to go ahead no matter what the data showed. They had some numbers in mind, and that's what they were going to go with. So that's sort of and I think, like you said, people say, oh, there's one report, then there's another report. I think this is the problem here, is that the waters are kind of muddied, mm-hmm. But if you actually spend some time with both reports, you see that the state version, it's quite a bit different. And but the problem is now, if we wanted to get some kind of compromise at the legislature, where because I think that the lower figures of that are offered in the state report that would be needed for a minimum wage, I think the companies could live with those with that figure. The problem is that the legislature is unlikely to want to preempt Minneapolis. You're just not going to have. It's going to be very difficult to get Minneapolis lawmakers at the legislature to override the city council. Just not going to want to do that politically. And Tim Walz is sort of like the governor had flirted with that idea, but I think he probably got some blowback when he even suggested that was a possibility, and he kind of walked that back yesterday. So it seems like for now this Minneapolis ordinance is in place, and the companies say that they're going to leave. Now, they could be bluffing. That wouldn't be the first time a corporation had not liked a potential policy and tried to bluff. But they also now, I think that, if and when they're faced with this kind of lobbying challenge in other places, if they do wind up bluffing, it's going to be bad for their credibility. And so they have quite a bit of motivation to follow through on the threat. Now, if and when they do follow through on the threat, now, what do we do about the 3 million airport rides that Uber and Lyft drivers managed in 2022? And we can probably, it's probably a greater number now because air traffic is, of course, increasing back to pre-pandemic levels. I'm not really sure that we have what it takes to move those people from the airport to the Twin Cities, and that's really just the start of the issues that have arisen here. So, I think that it's reasonable for us to expect Uber and Lyft to pay drivers better, and more specifically, Uber and Lyft's customers, and we ought to have a pay floor. The question is, how do you do it? How do you do it without crushing demand? Because we're talking about 10,000 drivers here. If Uber and Lyft leave, that's 10,000 people who have to find a different job. Or if the rates are so high that they wind up increasing prices a lot, and we're just not going to see as much. People will just not be taking Uber and Lyft as much. So there's a lot of nuance. There's some policy. There's some risks and benefits to balance out here. And that's not really what's happening, unfortunately, I don't think. I think it's we're kind of using a sledgehammer here, and I'm a little concerned about the consequences here in a couple months when it takes effect, actually May 1st.
When it comes to the idea of bringing in replacement companies, there certainly would be some that would be interested in coming in and filling that void of Uber and Lyft, but it would just be, as you've said, trying to get to that, to scaling up to the level of service that they would need to be able to fulfill that demand, because as you said, it would be enormous for any one company or even just a handful of companies to try to fill that void that could be there if Uber and Lyft both leave, at least in the short term for the first couple of years. Maybe in a few years they could fill that void, but there would be some problems, at least in the short term, and there are a lot of people who use that for going to the airport or just getting around town and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I had somebody tell me last week that, all it is an app on a phone and that can be replaced easily. I think that probably underestimates the technology involved with Uber and Lyft. And again, I'm not trying to say that these are great humanitarians here running these companies, but they do provide a service, and if that service goes away, then people are going to have to figure out what to do in their absence.
I think ultimately the crux of your column is before we make these big policy decisions, as the Minneapolis City Council did with passing these new rates for Uber drivers, let's make sure we have all of the data, because that does strike me as being not the best idea to decide to pass these rates and override Jacob Frey's veto the day before that state report comes out, which showed different rates. I like the analogy. I think you threw in the column talking about how this would be the equivalent of Republicans passing this big tax cut bill the day before, a report would be released that would show the impacts of what those tax cuts would have on the budget and the economy at large. I think it's the crux of it is let's make sure we have all the data before we make these big time policy decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that whenever we see somebody messing around with data or deliberately making decisions, in this case, the day before the state report comes out, I think we really have to question why it is they're doing that and whether or not they're acting in good faith, unfortunately. And so that was certainly my concern. And remember, they passed the ordinance the day before the report came out. They overrode the ordinance with that data in hand.
So they
rejected the state report out of hand, and even though it was again compiled by these two researchers who are labor friendly and attend and have a lot of experience. In this area, they've done a lot of academic research on Uber and Lyft, both on the wages and the expense side. So I think it was probably a mistake to just ignore that data analysis.
Read more about that column, which I believe you can find probably tomorrow over at the Reformer, over MinnesotaReformer.com, MinnesotaReformer.com, getting some facts about what's happening here with Uber and Lyft and the fact that their rates are going up in May 1st, but there's always the threat of being possibly preempted by the state and then Uber and Lyft threatening to leave. So there's still lots more to follow along with this story as it develops, especially as we approach that May 1st date when rates are going to go up in Minneapolis for Uber and Lyft drivers. One more story to touch on, and this has to do with more budget issues, but this time at the state level. Because last year, Governor Tim Walz and the Minnesota State Legislature passed a $72 billion budget. Now, this year, Walz released a plan which would call for about $250 million in new spending, which is very modest considering that we have the $72 billion budget, and probably more modest than people might have been expecting. The state budget agency is projecting about a $3.7 billion surplus, but with Walz's budget, we would be able to sit on about $2 million of reserves. So I'm curious, what struck you about this Governor Tim Walz budget? Was it necessarily the size and kind of the lack of spending considering the surplus we have? Or what jumped out at you, at least what you've seen from Governor's initial budget this year?
I've had a previous conversation with a DFL source of mine who had a good analogy for the what it's kind of felt like after last year's session. That was he compared it to going on a really good bender, and the feeling of you know, it was fun. And, I don't really remember all of it so well, but it seems like we had a great time, and I feel, you know, have a little bit of a hangover, tiniest bit of shame. So, I mean, you know, I'm joking. You know, that budget achieved a lot of policy goals, and we'll hopefully see that all that play out in the next few years. But I do think there's a sense amongst DFL folks, some of them, Governor Walz included, and I think that Speaker Melissa Hortman as well. It's her chamber that is standing for re-election this year. The Senate's not on the ballot, and they have a pretty slender majority. It's currently 70-60. It'll be 70-64 after a special election today. And so, you know, I don't think they want to give the drunken sailor vibes to voters, especially in some of those maybe second, third ring suburbs where they have to defend seats to keep that majority. So, yeah, it's a pretty slender slender supplemental budget. And despite a pretty significant wish list on the part of the legislature, it's pretty bare bones, and it's the legislature ultimately who they get to make these decisions, and Walz is probably not going to veto something, I don't think, and so they get to make the decisions, but he certainly has created a pretty slender skeletal structure, blueprint for his supplemental budget.
And where I was going to go next on this is, let's say the legislature and Walz aren't able to reach an agreement. Right now, it's only the state house that's going to be facing re-election here in the 2024 cycle, as, of course, Governor Walz and the state senate are not up for re-election. So you wonder if that might maybe give at least the house a little more leverage and the state legislature as a whole a little more leverage when they can say, well, we're the ones facing re-election here, Governor Walz. We can't really afford to have you veto these bills because, well, we need to get these passed to help some of our lawmakers who are facing tough re-election battles. So do you wonder if that could possibly play a role, of course, with the state house now facing re-election, where maybe they have a little more leverage if there's negotiations with Governor Walz coming up?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see him. He can be kind of conflict averse, so I don't really see him vetoing any package that comes over from a DFL-controlled legislature. I think that's highly unlikely. I think he's just going to have to try to dissuade them from going real big this year. But the reality is that there's very influential progressives in both caucuses and in the advocacy groups. And they think they were last year, as ambitious as it was, did not include enough, they think, for child care and certainly on education. Yeah, there was a big increase, but there was tied up in some pretty expensive mandates. And so that's where you have a number of school districts who say, despite the increase, they're struggling. I don't necessarily, you know, the speaker and the governor are powerful, influential people, but ultimately it's the two caucuses are going to make this decision, and the progressives have a lot more numbers and influence in both the House and Senate DFL caucuses than they did even 5 years ago. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Well, we'll have to leave it there as we are just about out of time, but you can read more about the budget that was proposed by Governor Tim Walz and maybe some of the differences between that and what the state legislature is asking for over at MinnesotaReformer.com. And make sure you read about Patrick's column on Uber and Lyft as well over at MinnesotaReformer.com. We have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan of the Minnesota Reformer. As always, thanks for coming on the show today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to be here.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
Uh-oh. Oh, by the way, before I get to this here, we do have a winner of the Stephanie Miller tickets. Patrick, who is our winner there?
Gail is our winner today. Congratulations, Gail.
Oh, well, congratulations, Gail. I hope you enjoy those tickets. We have got more pairs of tickets to give away later this week, so listen for your chance to call in. Apparently, Walter Hudson had a temper tantrum. He basically had a little outburst. He needed nap time. He says that the $300 million public safety aid allocated last year that should be allowed to buy armored vehicles for police departments. And, you know, when they're like, no, that's not what that's for, he basically threw a temper tantrum and was like, this is what they need. No, hey, you know, Walt, you know what they need is to take the damn guns off the streets. You know, back in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, there weren't people shooting at them with assault weapons. And maybe, just maybe, I know this might be hard for your mind, I guess, to process, but maybe the problem is the guns. Maybe the problem is the guns. So if you cannot be pro-cop unless you are pro-gun control. End of story. End of story. And no, we should not have a society where police departments that are dropping off, say, a restraining order at someone's house or something like that have to take an armored vehicle, full body armor, to go in there. That is not the society we should be looking for. End of story. I hope he got a nap time and some cookies and a little milk. I hope he did. Because sometimes people get cranky. Speaking of that, how about Tom Emmer getting cranky? He proposed canceling future invitations for President Joe Biden to deliver the State of the Union address calling the most recent iteration the divisive campaign speech. When has the State of the Union address not been a pseudo campaign speech? Seriously, when has the State of the Union not been a somewhat of a pseudo campaign speech? Of course it is. Emmer's just upset because Biden spanked them and spanked them badly. Emmer's remarks came during a Republican treat and retreat in West Virginia. Boy, wait a second. Your retreat was in West Virginia. Okay. You know, there are states that, it's fine. I'm sure that the moonshine's delicious. That was about the most divisive State of the Union. I wouldn't extend him the invitation next year if that's what they're going to get. Oh, talk about snowflakes. Clutch your pearls there, Tom. He added that it'll be a different president next year and that the Congress should rethink whether to invite the president to deliver another address. It was a campaign speech. It's always a campaign speech, you moron. God, man. How about I end today on an insanely positive note? Do you know how much I look up to and I love Mackenzie Scott? Mackenzie Scott, of course, is a philanthropist. Of course, was Bezos's ex, got a whole bunch of money in the divorce, more than she could ever spend in her lifetime. And as opposed to the rest of these clowns that go out and build up their rockets and buy social media sites, she basically has gone out and decided to give away this to the people that need it the most. And God bless her. Mackenzie Scott is an absolutely beautiful human being and should be praised as such. Gender equity organization, gender justice and LGBTQ plus equity organization Out Front Minnesota were each awarded $2 million from the latest $640 million pile of cash she gave out to organizations throughout the country today. This is an extraordinary opportunity for our organizations at a time when Minnesota continues to reshape the national narrative around LGBTQ plus rights, shared Kat Rohn, the executive director for Out Front Minnesota. For gender justice, this gift marks the largest one-time donation in the organization's history. With the conservative legal movement threatening our fundamental rights here in Minnesota, North Dakota, and across the United States, this gift could not come at a more crucial time, said gender justice executive director Megan Peterson. Job training nonprofit Twin Cities Rise received $3 million from Scott. Fantastic. This historic gift will allow us to accelerate our ambitious strategic plan, enabling us to empower more adults and youth facing formidable obstacles by promoting both the internal and external skills necessary to attain and retain meaningful career track jobs with sustaining wages, said Emma Corey, president and CEO of the Twin Cities Rise, in a press release. The Twin Cities organizations were chosen as part of the Yield Giving Open Call Initiative, which saw more than 6,300 applicants from across the nation. And and by the way, Rise, I believe they also focus mostly in North Minneapolis, so good for you. And many other groups as well got money from Mackenzie Scott and needed money for their organizations to survive. That is what good people do. That is what good people do. And I get it. There's part of our society that looks and says, she's wasting that money. She could have got a jet ski. She could have a super boat. She could have gone to Vegas. Nah, she gets it. She gets it completely. She has the ability to help millions. And Mackenzie Scott is doing so. Bless you. I love you. You are my hero. She really is. I love her. Native Ridge Radio is up next. Have a good one. We are back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.